Guardian Unlimited.
Hello, it's Monday, February the 12th, and you're listening to News Desk from Guardian Unlimited. My name's John Dennis. Today, how the chemical company Monsanto dumped thousands of tons of toxic waste in Britain, knowing full well that their chemicals could harm wildlife and people. The TV nutritionist Gillian McKeith has agreed not to call herself a doctor anymore. You'll hear why Ben Goldacre thinks she's a menace to science. In Turkmenistan in Central Asia, there's been an election. Not an election as you might understand it, but still, it might help the gas-rich country move on from the crackpot dictatorship it's lived under for the last 20-odd years. You'll hear why a bunch of MPs are being hauled around the Arctic Circle by huskies in the name of charity. And we'll consider what seemed impossible just a few days ago, a cricket triumph for England against Australia. Coming into bat with the Guardian Diary, John Henley's with us, and Ros Taylor's bowling us a few fast ones from today's papers. Don't you just love cricket metaphors? The Environment Agency is investigating one of the most contaminated sites in the country. It could cost £100 million to clear up the Brafiskyn Quarry near Cardiff in South Wales. 67 chemicals, including some that could have only been made by Monsanto, are leaking from the quarry 30 years after they were disposed of there. Here's our environment editor, John Vidal.
Well, it's not just Monsanto. We're going back 30-odd years or more when, to be absolutely fair, there was less science knowledge around, and there was very, very lax environmental regulations. And we had there was a very large Monsanto works down in Newport, still there. One of the things it was making was PCBs, is polychlorinated biphenyls, which is a really nasty chemical which was very, very useful at the time. In a nutshell, they gave the PCBs to various companies, and they had them dumped, and they had them dumped in unlined pits, and now they are still leaking after 30 years, and they're still dangerous.
You've been to the toxic waste dump at Brafiskyn Quarry. Can you describe it?
Well, it's extraordinary. I mean, 25, 30 years ago, you'd hardly seen any houses at all. It's about 4 miles from Cardiff. It was an old quarry, and you now see cliffs about 20, 30 feet high on three sides, and the rest is just a flat field. And what has happened is that it was filled up with chemicals, not just from the Monsanto works, but from all over South Wales for about 5 years, 1967 up to 1970-odd. So now there's 130 feet's worth of very, very nasty chemicals down there.
And did Monsanto know the likely effects of its actions?
Well, shall we say, this is where it gets interesting, because we got a lot of papers from old court cases which came up in America, which showed that headquarters in America back in the 1950s and throughout the 60s were getting very, very worried about the health effects and the pollution of PCBs. What these chemicals were spectacularly different from others in the sense that they, what they call bioaccumulate, so they continually add into the systems of any living beings. And what they were finding in the 1960s was that these were accumulating in fish, in plants, in wildlife, and in rivers, and absolutely everywhere. So wherever there was life, there was the evidence that the company knew that they had a very, very big pollution problem.
And how much will it cost to clean up this mess?
This is what the Environment Agency, I understand, is trying to work out now. The cost could be anywhere between 10, 15 million, absolute minimum, up to at least 100 million, and I've heard even more. And it's not just the one quarry, there's another quarry as well. We haven't even looked at that one. Monsanto weren't the only company involved in this one. There were others, and there's five. The Environment Agency has been really talking to about five or six different groups and organisations about how it's going to apportion the cost. No one denies the chemicals are there. The question is, whose fault was it? How did they get there? And how are we going to clear it up?
What's the government been doing to protect the public?
Well, this is another big problem because, frankly, the government does not want to know. Nobody wants to know because it's just a problem. It's like it's an old tip. It's 30 years old, 100 million quid. Nobody wants to prosecute the companies. It's very complicated and there's no guarantee. On the other hand, the government doesn't want to suddenly find 100 million quid to sort this out. The local authority doesn't want to do that. It's absolutely furious about what's going on. The local health protection agency is exactly the same. This is the problem which won't go away, which nobody wants to deal with.
What's Monsanto got to say for itself?
Well, Monsanto doesn't deny that these chemicals were being made in its works. I mean, it can't deny that at all. There is obviously disputes over how they actually got there. Now, who contracted who to do what, precisely when, at what point? This is what the Environment Agency is trying to find out now. So this is what the investigation is about.
John, many thanks. Ros Taylor's with us, having had a look at today's papers. Ros, the headline in The Independent today, Target Tehran.
The Independent says that the case for going to war in Iran is being ramped up in the US and by the Pentagon. It picks up on a news conference which military officials held yesterday in Baghdad, where they displayed some weapons which they said they'd got from Shia militants and had come from Iran. The Independent's very sceptical about this, so is the New York Times. The Independent in particular says that these accusations are bizarre and even more insubstantial than the dossier on WMD that you may remember that implicated Saddam Hussein in having weapons of mass destruction. And it says that everything suggests that the US is just trying to make the case for another invasion or at least another attack. And it wonders why the term EFPs, which stands for explosively formed penetrators, has just been coined to describe one of these weapons. Was it chosen to imply that a menacing new weapon has been developed? In fact, this weapon is nearly 100 years old.
Now, Ros, did David Cameron, the leader of the Conservative Party, inhale?
That's a question not many people ask today. I think there's an assumption that he did, John.
Okay.
I think we can probably assume that he probably wouldn't have wasted his time unless he was going to. But
maybe the question is, why should we care, though?
Well, no one is particularly surprised by the revelation came out yesterday that David Cameron smoked cannabis at Eton and quite possibly at Oxford as well. He won't comment. He says he's got a right to a private life and a life before politics, but the tabloids unsurprisingly want to know a bit more about what went on. The Mirror in particular, which has a picture of him in a tailcoat in Oxford ball in 1987, just to remind us that while he may smoke cannabis, he's still not like the rest of us.
Now, the French presidential candidate Ségolène Royal has finally announced some policies.
100 of them, actually. She set out her presidential manifesto. She calls it a pact yesterday. And it's pretty left-wing. It certainly puts some clear water between her and her rival, Nicolas Sarkozy. The Telegraph's not impressed at all. It says she's just giving the French what they think they want, but if they think about it properly, they'll realise they won't want that at all. It describes her as a politician who simply echoes their whining back at them.
Now, something that I think the Telegraph are probably quite happy about, a triumph for the Queen, Helen Mirren, to be more specific.
The other Queen, Queen number two. Yes, she won Best Actress at the BAFTAs last night for her portrayal of the Queen in the movie The Queen, wearing some champagne silk. For my money, Ava Green looked better, but anyway. And she, according to the Mirror, swore on live TV twice.
Fantastic. Good luck to her. Now, tell us about this scheme to sell Viagra over the counter for the first time in Britain.
This is very exciting, John. It's really...
excitement. It's not. I'm excited for professional reasons, not for personal reasons.
Well, a therapist tells a son it'll be huge. I think we know what that means, don't we?
Many thanks, Ros. And don't forget to subscribe to The Wrap. That's our daily email service, of course, by going to guardian.co.uk/wrap. Gillian McKeith, the presenter of You Are What You Eat on Channel 4, isn't going to describe herself as a doctor anymore on her company's advertising. There'd been a complaint to the Advertising Standards Authority from a Guardian reader who claimed she was misleading the public. He'd read one of our Bad Science columns written by Ben Goldacre.
Well, I mean, she's a very, very prominent figure. She calls herself Dr. Gillian McKeith, PhD. She's got a primetime television show on Channel 4 now in its fourth series. She's got best-selling books. She's number one and number three in the most borrowed books from public libraries. And she sort of presents herself as this very scientific figure. She performs blood tests, wears a white coat, she's a doctor, she examines patients, talks about treatment models for them, all that kind of stuff. But in reality, her misunderstanding of science is not just a matter of sort of nuances. I mean, she gets the most basic GCSE biology stuff completely wrong, as far as I can tell. I mean, it's absolute madness.
Can you give us some examples of how wrong she gets it?
She talks endlessly in several of her books about how chlorophyll is high in oxygen. You should eat lots of dark green leaves because that contains more chlorophyll and that will really oxygenate your blood. But the reality is, of course, that chlorophyll only makes oxygen in light. And, you know, it's very dark in your bowels. It's not going to make any oxygen in there. And even if you put a searchlight up your bum just to prove a point, and it did make some oxygen, but then if it did make oxygen, you wouldn't absorb oxygen through your bowel because your bowel isn't for absorbing oxygen. That's what your lungs are for. And in fact, actually, I mean, as anyone who's ever lit their farts could tell you, mixing methane in your bowel with oxygen is a potentially explosive combination. I mean, it's madness. It's not dangerous. It's just stupid.
But hasn't she improved the nation's diet?
Well, that is a tricky one to measure, isn't it? I mean, if she has, it's at a great cost. Firstly, it's at the cost of somebody quite significantly promoting the public misunderstanding of science and misrepresenting the very notion of what it is to have a kind of scientific evidence base for a dietary intervention. I mean, this is a woman who produces these sort of endless sort of books and mail-outs where they're sort of full of references. It's got this air of referenciness. But when you follow up the references and look what she's actually referencing, what documents she's referencing, they're sort of magazines like Earth Letter, or they're papers that she claims support her assertions but actually do nothing of the sort. So I think firstly it's quite dangerous to have somebody in such a prominent position misrepresenting the very notion of what it is for there to be a scientific evidence base for an intervention. Secondly, to have somebody like that sort of misrepresenting the evidence for their own interventions. I mean, the reality is that the kind of obsessive tinkering that you get from mainstream media nutritionists is not backed up by rigorous research data. Eating your greens has got a sound evidence base. Getting exercise, not being overweight, moderate alcohol consumption and not smoking have all got a convincing evidence base. But that kind of, speaking in general terms, kind of media nutritionist, you've got to eat a handful of Brazil nuts every day to make sure that you're not deficient in selenium. That kind of nonsense just isn't backed up by proper scientific evidence. And I think to promote that kind of overcomplicated and confusing and unnecessarily overcomplicated and confusing dietary advice, it's actually quite confusing for people, quite apart from the fact that the food she recommends is also very sort of unpleasant. She's got a very kind of Protestant, puritanical take on the kind of healthy foods that you should eat. The reality is that the most significant risk factors, the most significant lifestyle risk factors for ill health is social class. And I think that the obsession that the media has with promoting the notion that you can somehow tinker with your cardiovascular and cancer risk factors by obsessively ruminating over your diet is actually a huge distraction from the realities of the social lifestyle risk factors for ill health.
For 21 years, Turkmenistan was ruled by one of the world's most authoritarian dictators. Sir Parmerat Niyazov built gold statues of himself, named towns, public buildings and even a meteorite after himself as part of a very odd personality cult. Well, with Niyazov's death comes an opportunity for change. And yesterday, voters went to the polls to elect a new president. Here's The Guardian's Luke Harding.
For Turkmenistan, this is a bit like the moment in the Soviet Union after Stalin died in the 1950s. Really, everybody was expecting Niyazov to go on and on and on. He was president for life, and then abruptly in his mid-60s, he dropped dead in December, which has left a sort of huge vacuum in Turkmenistan's extraordinary kind of politics, which has really been dominated by Niyazov for two decades. Now, what happened yesterday was that Turkmens actually had a choice of people to vote for. They had six candidates they could vote for. Admittedly, they didn't have a choice of political parties. That all the candidates were from the same party. And it now looks almost certain that Turkmenistan's acting president, Gurbanguly Berdimuhamedov, whose name I have to say is rather hard to pronounce, is going to be installed as the new president on Wednesday.
Do we know whether the election was fair?
Well, Fair. That's a very good question. I think by standards of classical Greek democracy, no, this election was not fair insofar as Turkmenistan's opposition were not allowed back into the country. This is a country with, you know, a sort of desert-dominated, gas-rich country with no tradition of democracy whatsoever, which has been ruled, I think, tyrannically by Niyazov up until now. But it was the country's first multi-candidate election for 21 years, and foreign observers were there but are not issuing reports. I have to say, sadly, the Guardian, me, I wasn't there either because, along with, I think, almost all foreign journalists, the Turkmens refused to give us visas. So, no, it wasn't fair, but it was an election.
What can you tell us about the man who's expected to be the new president, Gurbanguly Berdimuhamedov?
Not a great deal. He's a former dentist in his late 40s. I think, interestingly, really what happened with Niyazov was as soon as any other kind of government ministers became powerful in their own right, they were immediately kind of thrown into jail. Now, certainly, Berdimuhamedov has survived, and he was a health minister, and he unusually has sort of survived these various kind of palace coups in Turkmenistan. He's kept a low profile ahead of yesterday's election, although one of my sources says he was spotted campaigning in a market and shaking hands with people like a kind of Western-style politician. But I think the thing one can say quite safely is that he's not going to try and emulate the kind of really rather weird personality cult of his predecessor, who built gold statues to himself while his people sort of sunk into poverty. And he's hinted that he will introduce modest reforms in Turkmenistan, including improving access to the internet.
What kind of other changes do you think we can expect to happen? Because Turkmenistan has been a very closed country, hasn't it?
It's been impossible to visit for foreigners for a very long time. I think we'll see sort of certainly an improvement on things like sort of pensions and education and health reforms. I mean, the country really is in a state of dire poverty and backwardness at the moment. There's a prospect that foreign NGOs may be allowed into the country and that Berdimuhamedov will try and improve relations with Washington and with the European Union. Having said that, I think there's no prospect whatsoever that there'll be any kind of meaningful democracy inside the country.
The supply of gas has been a very fraught subject among the international community in the last couple of years. What effect might a new open or more open Turkmenistan have on the world's energy markets?
Turkmenistan has the world's fifth largest supplies of gas. I mean, at the moment, Turkmenistan exports all of its gas through Russia. Now, obviously, what Western European countries, Western oil firms are hoping is that the country will diversify. Whether that happens, you know, we'll have to wait.
Westminster Challenge is a new organisation that aims to bring politicians and charities closer together. With that in mind, they've sent some of our MPs to the Arctic to raise money for charity. With them in Ovre Sopero is our very own Tanya Branigan.
The idea is to really get MPs working, raising some money for charity, and hopefully they'll raise about £100,000 through sponsorship over the course of this week. But the other thing is actually, I think, to sort of show that MPs are doing something useful. People are quite cynical about politics often, and this is really sort of an attempt to show that they're doing good work.
A lot of people remember David Cameron posing with the Huskies in the Arctic. Are these MPs doing anything different?
Yes, it's a lot more challenging than that, I have to say. In fact, one of the MPs on the trip, Ed Vasey, is not just a shadow culture minister, he's also a very, very close ally of David Cameron. I did ask him if he'd picked up any tips, but sadly, Cameron hasn't given him a single word of advice on how to mush.
Dear me.
He seems to be doing quite well on his own, though. I mean, it's a pretty challenging schedule. Bear in mind, we're going around 60 kilometres a day. It's down to minus 23 out there, so we're all pretty chilly, even with our multiple layers of socks. Generally, yeah, it's pretty rough. And last night we even slept in igloos that they'd built themselves.
It must cost quite a lot to fly MPs out to the Arctic. Isn't the... I hope their flights are being offset.
They are all being offset, yes. That's a question that's come up quite a lot. And actually, I mean, certainly for Emily Thornberry, for example, and Nick Clegg has mentioned this as well, Nick Clegg from the Lib Dems, Emily Thornberry from Labour, they're both sort of very interested in the environment, worried about global warming, and they did want to sort of see the impact it's had here. But they were also very keen to make sure that they didn't increase that, obviously, and therefore all the flights and all the transport is being offset. And the actual journey itself, of course, is by Husky sled, so that's pretty green, I think.
And which charities are involved in this?
This is all in aid of the Children's Society, Cancer Research and Crime Stoppers, and the results are the profits are going to be sort of divided equally between the three. And they've actually sent representatives along themselves, so they're doing some of the hard work too.
And what lessons do you think MPs have learned about the environment from this?
We had a really interesting talk the other night from one of the members of the local Sami community. The Sami are the indigenous people here. And Niklas, who's from the Sami Institute, which sort of obviously sort of tries to preserve and study their heritage, is actually the first generation of his family to be sedentary and not to sort of move and migrate and follow the reindeer herds. He was saying that one of the really striking things is how the reindeer are suffering because of the way the climate's changed. It's become much more volatile. It's not just that the climate's rising here, but it's actually going up and down a lot. It was minus 37 last week. It's about minus 10 this week. And it's really going up and down. And the problem is when it defrosts and then refreezes, you get this very, very hard layer of ice under the snow, and that means the reindeer can't get to the lichen anymore, with the result that about 140,000 reindeer out of about 250,000, I think, in Sweden, are actually having to be artificially fed this year.
Now, John Henley's with us with The Guardian Diary. John, I trust The Guardian is promoting the values of a good sex education.
Absolutely, yes, indeed, John. And we will be lamenting the fact that, according to a survey that's just come out this morning, nearly one in three Britons apparently thinks that if a woman jumps up and down, washes, or goes to the loo immediately after sex, she can prevent pregnancy. Seems to us a little bit more might be doing, need to be doing in that direction. We will be warning us all also against the dangers of MP3 players. This courtesy of Gannett newspapers in Wisconsin, who report the case of one Ryan Eagle driving north along Interstate 43 near the Sheboygan, Manitowoc County line over the weekend, tried to adjust his MP3 player in the cab, up off the road, truck flips over. 40 tons of cow intestines on the interstate. We've also been in touch. Yeah, young Josh Green has been in touch. I don't know whether you recall him. In Friday's diary, he was the young Lib Dem researcher who complained in this very organ, actually. In fact, in The Guardian a couple of weeks ago about the fact that he'd been working in Westminster for a whole year and hadn't got laid. This was in light of the BBC Two Party Animals series, all about drunken and debauched young political researchers in Westminster. So Josh complained, and on Friday's diary we had a small item noting that Sir Ming Campbell had taken the poor lad under his wing and said, "Oh, he's very, very sorry for him undergoing such a painful drought, and anybody sees him, will he please tell him to keep his pecker up?" Anyway, young Josh has been back in touch to say that he would like to clarify his position, and Josh, we're only too pleased to allow you to do so. He says the article stated that I've never got laid in the last year. This is not strictly true. It actually refers to the fact that I haven't in fact had any sexual relations with my Westminster colleagues. To say that I haven't got laid at all is a trifle exaggeration. So we're absolutely delighted to put the record straight, Josh. And finally, although as you well know, we make no fun of people's names on this column, we will perhaps just be pointing out that the road safety officer for Bath and North East Somerset Council is one Laurie Davis. Thank you very much.
Many thanks to you, John. And don't forget to keep John supplied with your items for the diary by emailing him, diary@guardian.co.uk. England now have a real chance of winning the Cricket World Cup. That's what England's victorious captain Andrew Flintoff said after his touring side swept aside Australia in the final of the one-day series Down Under. England fought back after a humiliating Ashes whitewash. I asked Lawrence Booth, our cricket correspondent, where did it all go right?
I think if you look back to the way the series developed, there was a game England played against New Zealand where they were chasing about 300 and they were 200 for 8 or so, and they needed to prevent New Zealand getting a bonus point. And Paul Nixon came out and played quite well for 49, and England got up to 250 odd for 8, prevented New Zealand getting that point. After that, they went on and beat Australia. Ed Joyce got 100. And I wonder whether they look back at that New Zealand match. They started to show a bit of fight, and they suddenly got a bit of confidence, which hadn't been with them throughout the entire tour, throughout the Ashes, the 5-0 defeat and the disastrous sequence of results in the one-day series. Yeah, very hard to say. It's almost inexplicable.
Because, as you say, I mean, England have a relatively young and inexperienced team in the one-day format of the game, but they've done so much better than their more experienced test match colleagues.
Yeah, it's a mystery. I mean, when they arrived in Australia, the thought was that they might have a chance in the Ashes series, but they were absolute no-hopers in the one-day series. I mean, England have really been a poor one-day team since they reached the final of the 1992 World Cup, and things have gone badly wrong since then. It's not entirely clear whether the four wins in a row will signal an upturn in their one-day fortunes. They've got the World Cup coming up, of course. They've had three successive shockers in the World Cup, and most of us were predicting a fourth successive howler this time. Of course, we might have to revise our opinions now. But yes, they kind of reversed the form that everyone expected. So, you know, nice way to end the tour after the miseries of the earlier part of it.
What about Andrew Flintoff's captaincy? Because he was widely criticised after the Ashes mauling.
Yeah, he's done very well. I mean, there was a lot of debate before the Ashes about whether he should be captain. Should it be him or should it be Andrew Strauss? And after the Ashes, I think all the people who supported Flintoff's case had to put their hand up and say, no, we got that one wrong. I was among them. However, he's now kind of galvanised the team somehow. His bowling has been outstanding. His batting's been pretty good too. Duncan Fletcher, the England coach, said the other day that he felt that Flintoff was a more relaxed player when he wasn't captain. And I don't know whether that was a kind of deliberate kick up the backside for Flintoff to spur him on and try to get him to prove the coach wrong. I don't know, but it seems to have worked. And he, for the first time on the tour the other day, he had a smile on his face when he was lifting the trophy, and it was great to see. And you know, they'll probably encourage him to think that he can do the job at the World Cup.
Lawrence Booth. Well, today's show is produced by Ben Green and Phil Maynard. I'm John Dennis. Thanks for listening.
Guardian Unlimited.